From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When New Hampshire's governor or members of our congressional delegation speak out on policy issues, people pay attention, and it's considered news. But for most of us in our day-to-day lives, it's the decisions of unsung and often unknown local leaders that matter most, from road repair to waste hauling to property taxes. So today in The Exchange, we're going local with four town and city managers from around the state talking about the challenges and rewards of their jobs. And let's hear from you. What do you think local government here in New Hampshire does well, and what doesn't it do well? Where are its abilities limited by state or federal policies? And how do you think state policy choices have helped or hurt your own community? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Julia Griffin, town manager for Hanover. Julia, good to see you. Welcome back.
My pleasure.
Also with us, Michael Joyle, city manager for Dover. Michael, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Also with us, Scott Myers, city manager for Laconia. Scott, welcome.
Thank you.
And also with us, Kevin Smith, town manager for Londonderry. And Kevin, welcome back to you too.
Great to be here.
Well, and all of you, but I want to start with you, Kevin, just in three or four sentences, give us your job description. If someone said, town manager, what's that?
I actually get that question every now and then, Laura. The way I usually describe it to people is it's almost a little like being the mayor, except you're not elected, you're appointed. And on any given day, you're fielding questions from residents and stakeholders of the town on issues ranging from property taxes to code zoning violations, economic development. It can really run the gamut. And you're overseeing every aspect of town government with the exception of the library and the school district.
So, and we've got two town managers and two city managers here. And as I'm guessing, we'll learn about some of the differences. But so you're appointed, Kevin.
Appointed by a 5-member town council.
And you don't have a mayor because you're not a city.
We don't have a mayor, no. And the neat thing about New Hampshire is the municipalities are all set up a little bit differently. There's actually some guidance in state law about how you can set up your town or city. Oftentimes people think, well, if you're a city, you must have a population of over 30,000 people. And that's just not the case, as you know.
No, in fact, your town of Londonderry is a lot bigger than more than one city in New Hampshire.
That's true. Yeah, we're about 26,000. We are a very large town, but we're not actually a city.
So our other town manager, as I said, is Julia Griffin from Hanover. And Julia, so if somebody came up to you at a party and said, town manager, what is that all about?
So we're the chief executive officer for our community, but we're also jugglers. The fun part about our job is the variety of departments we oversee. I report to a 5-member select board, so I'm appointed by that 5-member board. And I do have libraries in my purview, unlike some towns. But what's most interesting for me is the wide variety of tasks that we get involved with on a day-to-day basis, which just makes the job never boring.
Well, in a recent Concord Monitor article, Durham's town manager described the job this way. It's a nuanced and challenging profession requiring integrity, broad knowledge of municipal operations, hard work, considerable experience, long days and nights, working with municipal staff and the public. Does that sound about right,
that
Julia?
Sounds very much like Todd Selig, who's very thoughtful in terms of what our profession entails. And yes, that's right. Spot on, Todd.
So what do you think, Michael? How would you describe it?
Well, I think that my job is more about being a coach and a facilitator. I kind of use a sailboat analogy as being a helmsman to help steer the community in the direction that it wants to go to get to the destination that it wants to be.
And you are in a city, so you've got a mayor. In fact, we've interviewed her on this program before. So how is that different?
Well, we have a strong council, manager form of government. And in our case, we have a city council that consists of 9 members. One of the councilors is elected as the mayor. The mayor is essentially the chairperson for the city council and serves as a spokesperson for the community. But that person has no administrative responsibilities. They simply are responsible for facilitating the policy discussions and ultimately the actions of the council. And then my role is to support them in allowing them to ultimately make whatever decisions they want to make on behalf of the community.
So, Scott, same question, but a little asked a little differently. What don't Laconia residents get about your job? What are some of the questions or requests that you receive where you just think, no, that's not really what I do?
There are a lot of times they think that I'm making the decisions or setting the policy, and I really say that belongs to the mayor and the council. And
right, because you're a city.
So we're a city. So I described it as I'm the CEO for the organization, and the mayor and the city council are the board of directors. So they set the legislative policy, they set the fiscal policy. It's my job to then hire the department heads and their staffs funnel up through them, but I implement the policy of the mayor and council, and they're obviously responding to their constituents. So a lot of duties in there. I also say there are a lot of things that fall under other duties as may be assigned, because every day is different and interesting, and you never know what you're going to wake up to.
Well, what's a typical day?
A typical day is getting...
If there is one.
a lot of meetings. Typically, I try to quickly scan a lot of newspapers in the state because I learn a lot of information from what's going on in other communities. And I know some of my counselors also read a lot of papers, and they'll say, hey, how come we're not doing what this community is doing or that community is doing? So it's always good to have a sense of what's going on statewide. Obviously, connecting with staff, hot ticket items. You know, people know how to reach me 24/7. I may not always respond, but I usually will read them and get a sense of what's going on. So a lot of meetings, interacting with the public, working with various departments, putting out fires, responding to potholes. Why did my trash get picked up, and how come the snowplow knocked over my mailbox?
I bet you got a lot of that this winter. How come we don't? I bet you get that a lot, Kevin. People say, well, you know, my friend lives in, you know, Dover or Concord. How come we don't?
How come we don't what?
How come we don't do this or this or this? What's the extent of what people seem to want from their local government these days?
I think their expectations are pretty reasonable for the most part. As Scott was saying, oftentimes people will read the papers and see what's going on in other towns and other communities, and they'll say, hey, is this something that we could do in Londonderry? Is this something you can look into? And you want to respond to them, so you end up doing the research, end up looking into those things. But I think, you know, for the most part, people's expectations of what local government can and can't do is fairly reasonable, although we did encounter it recently with the elections. And of course, for the second year in a row, we had a massive snowstorm on Election Day. And there was a little bit of, well, how come you can't postpone the election? And that began a very interesting discussion into town and state government and how different roles function in those matters.
Well, and that's part of the reason why we decided to do this show today, is to explore sort of what cities and towns can and cannot do here in New Hampshire, what powers the state holds. So we'll definitely talk about that. I want to invite our listeners to join us. 1-800-892-6477 is our number here in The Exchange. 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we're getting local. We're talking about the day-to-day decisions at the city and town level that can have a big impact on our lives. We've got a panel of local leaders here talking about the challenges and rewards of their jobs, and we'll ask them what they'd like to see from the state. Let's hear from you. What do you want to know about what your own local government can and can't do? How do you think state policy choices have helped or hurt your community? Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange. One more question for you, and then I do want to get into this idea of what the state says you can do and can't do, because we think we have local control. We think we have a lot of home rule. Michael's shaking his head. We don't have nearly as much as we think. But what's a typical day for you, Julia?
Oh, there's today's a good example, Laura. I'm down here, and then I'm headed to a legislative hearing on net metering. Last minute change in the net metering proposed legislation that has a lot of us concerned, those of us who are looking at community solar. So I'll probably spend between 11 and 1 or 1:30 sitting in an overcrowded hearing room ill-equipped to handle the crowd that I suspect will show up to testify against the proposed amendment to legislation, which we had supported, that folks were excited about. Then I have to dash back to Hanover. I have a 2:30 meeting to talk about pedestrian safety and crosswalk lighting, particularly around the campus.
Well, because an older woman was hit by a bicyclist
that's
in Hanover,
right,
a couple months ago.
Yep. Yeah. So a lot of concerns around pedestrian and bicycle and lighting safety for pedestrians in our community. So we're working on that issue. And then I have to go to a meeting around Sustainable Hanover committee that's working on a community solar project. And then I have an early evening meeting regarding affordable housing and particularly workforce housing in the Hanover-Lebanon area.
Yeah, which is a big, big issue there, as I know. So from solar energy to pedestrian safety, back to renewable energy, and then on to affordable housing.
That's just between 2:30 and tonight at probably 9 p.m. So, yeah.
What do you think, Michael? Give us a flavor.
Well, every day is a little bit different. I think the one constant is spend most of the day communicating with citizens and staff and our department directors. As Julia noted, the topics vary from day to day, and they're wide ranging. Anything and everything to do with the community. The hours are from first thing in the morning till often late at night. Actually, that's when I get most of my work done. Caught up on emails is at nighttime, and there's weekends involved with community events and so forth, and being visible and knowing and being out with the residents and understanding what their interests are in the community.
What about housing? That's a biggie in Dover as well, isn't it, Michael?
It is. Housing is a big concern. Dover's going through a period of tremendous growth. The community has over the years positioned itself for the changes that are happening right now, and we've always had a concern in the Seacoast area about affordable housing and workforce housing, and it's in today's economy, it's becoming even more of an issue, particularly as the Seacoast is booming, the economy in the Seacoast, and making sure that we have adequate housing for the workers that are needed in the industries that are locating there.
And you guys bill yourselves as the affordable seacoast, right? If you can't afford Portsmouth, come on over to Dover.
Well, I think we are, and that's an issue. Is that as the seacoast has been increasing, folks are looking at Dover as an attractive place to move, and businesses are looking at Dover. But there's a constant challenge in that we don't price ourselves out of the market, and ultimately become a community where folks are now going to move out of and move to other communities.
Well, we've definitely talked so many times about housing on this program, so I might ask some of you about that again later. But let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We're talking about local government today on The Exchange with four city and town managers, the challenges of their jobs, what they'd like to see from the state, what powers they have, what powers they don't have to make life better in their communities. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you Dons calling in from Nashua. Hi, Don. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I want to throw a little bit of cold water on the whole thing. I grew up in the Midwest back in the 50s, 60s, and we had a town manager, and he ended up buying into urban renewal, and probably either convinced the city powers or didn't even have to, since he had no contract, no limits on what he could do. Ended up tearing down about a quarter of the city, which stayed vacant for a long time, and then turned around and almost gave it away to the county because we were the county seat. And they built buildings in there that had no tax base, didn't pay any taxes. The city's now a shadow of its former self. And I just viewed the whole thing very negatively, and think that probably is one of the worst things that can happen to a city, unless, of course, the managers just manage. Instead of trying to be promotional and have all of these great ideas, often that don't work.
So not enough local buy-in, it sounds like, Scott. We're doing urban renewal, boom, we're going to tear everything down. How much local buy-in do you have to put forward in Laconia?
Well, I'm sorry Don had that experience.
Yeah, me too, Don.
I don't hear a lot of those type of stories around the state. And you really do need the local buy-in, and that starts with you as a manager, with your team, with your staff, with your elected officials, with the folks who serve on your various boards and commissions. That's a big challenge, is how do we engage the public today when everyone is so busy? Social media platforms, public access TV, tweeting, trying to put information out through electronic newsletters. It's really a challenge to engage the public. And I think almost every community can look at that and say, we'd like the magic pill on how we can solve that problem. But it's vitally important, especially if you are talking about something significant as an urban renewal project, where in this case they were talking about tearing down buildings. But even on something simple like changing no parking or putting in a dog park or something even that seems relatively positive, if you don't get the word out, if you don't in some cases over-communicate, you get someone who comes in at the last minute and can just throw the kibosh into a whole project that you may have spent months on because you haven't done that extra outreach. And sometimes you get the fatigue and say, we've had so many meetings, we've put it out there so often, but I think it's better to over-communicate and not get that surprise at the 11th hour than not to do it that way.
Well, I really appreciate the call, and it raises something that we talked about with our town moderators on our town meeting show a month or so ago, and it's the idea that, you know, you're making really big decisions that affect people's daily lives, especially in a town, Kevin. I'm turning to you because Londonderry is a town. You know, do folks show up at town meeting? If they don't, how else do you engage them? Or then if you guys go ahead and make decisions and then people get mad and they say, hey, what are you doing to my town? So it's kind of tough, isn't it? You know,
it is. It is tough because you want to try to engage the local citizenry as much as possible. And we do that through having, you know, more meetings sometimes than we need to have on certain items, just to try to engage the public more.
And do people show up?
Not as many as we'd like to show up,
yeah.
Laura, you know, and it doesn't matter whether it's voting day, deliberative session. You know, when they show up is when they hear something like, hey, there might be a dog park put in a residential area. Well, then it's suddenly everybody shows up in that particular residential area because it's something that's going to affect their daily lives. But not that this other stuff doesn't affect their daily lives, but there seems to be a disconnect sometimes. And so it's often hard to engage the local citizenry on local issues. But I would echo what Scott was just saying earlier about really needing buy-in on issues. I would be surprised if what Don experienced in the Midwest could ever happen in New Hampshire, because we're so much about local control and everybody having a voice. And you have so many boards and commissions at the local level, be it the planning board, the selectmen, the town council, historical commissions, heritage commissions, and everyone on these boards wants to have a voice on particular issues. And so to me, absolutely, you need buy-in from people, whether the issue is big or small.
And the system that you're describing is a system I'm familiar with. It's been here in New Hampshire forever, local government, boards, commissions, and so forth. But it seems like other younger generations maybe aren't as interested as serving on the commission and meeting twice a month and going through a long meeting at night. And, you know, I mean, I myself haven't done any of that because I've got kids, I've got a job, you know, I'm busy, blah, 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 all the excuses. So I just wonder if you think about that, Kevin. Are there other ways of engaging with people besides the sort of, here's the historical commission and we hope you serve?
Well, again, you know, we try to do things via social media as well and get the word out on social media. There's a new Londonderry Moms page in which you have a lot of younger moms that are engaged on that particular form of social media, and we put information out on there as well. But you're absolutely right, Laura, trying to engage the next generation of leadership is difficult, and I totally get it. People have families. There's a lot going on with sports activities and other things in their daily lives. They may not have time for a night meeting, even if it is only once a month, because there's already a lot going on in their lives.
Well, that's something we all can pick up on after a short break. So, Don, I'm so glad you called, because this is an important point. You can join us, too, 1-800-892-6477. So engaging locally, we'll talk about that coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's a panel of city and town managers. From potholes to property taxes, we're looking at the challenges and rewards of leading locally these days. And let's get your questions in. What do you think your local government does well? What doesn't it do well? How do state decisions affect your community? And how do we engage people in community decision making so that they feel like they've got a role in making the city or town a better place? Send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. So, Michael, let's hear from you, too, on that point that Don raised, feeling like decisions are just made by city or town managers like you guys. The public doesn't have a voice. And then the community is, you know, as he put it, kind of ruined.
Well, it's an unfortunate experience that Don had, but I think New Hampshire is a little bit different, as Kevin was alluding to, and that here we do have very active citizen boards and committees. But most importantly, particularly in Dover, I mean, our city council, our mayor and city council, they ultimately are representing the citizens of the community, the entire citizenry. And they're being advised by other citizens who are on various boards and commissions, and ultimately they're making policy. They're making decisions about the direction or whether or not we're going to have a dog park or we're going to do urban renewal or whatever the issue is that they think is important for the community to undertake at any particular time. And then it's my responsibility as a city manager to take that direction and make it happen. And unfortunately, that sometimes puts me and other managers in the spot of taking the blunt of the criticism. For that, we have to have thick skin. That comes with the job.
So how do you weigh out the interests? Because as you guys all know way better than me, and Julie, I'll turn to you first, when you talk about citizen input and helping you make these decisions that matter, there are voices that are louder than others. If something is going to be built in a particular neighborhood, as Kevin alluded to, all those people are going to come out. If there's a zoning change that will really help one business, that business is going to put all their energy and efforts into that zoning change, whereas the average person in town might think, well, I don't know, I don't really understand zoning, I'm busy that night, it doesn't sound good to me. So how do you attune your ears to the importance of all the various voices, if you know what I'm saying? Sometimes there are business interests, corporate interests, neighborhood interests that maybe not the interests of the entire community, but they're speaking more loudly.
We have a lot of competing interests in the work that we do and in communities. That's part of what makes communities so much fun to manage and so interesting and complex. I think the key is an open ear. Managers need to be accessible to be able to receive the input from those interests and to be honest enough to have a clear and open dialogue with those individuals or groups about why we may be landing on an issue the way we are based on trying to balance competing interests and the needs of the overall community. We deal with a lot in Hanover, particularly around the campus's proposed growth and development on the periphery that impacts neighborhoods that don't want to see that indoor practice facility or that new dormitory built in their neighborhood, even though the property on which it will be constructed is zoned for college construction. So we deal with a lot of those kinds of not in my backyard conversations in our community. And ultimately, in that case, a really diplomatic planning board is crucial in having everybody feel they've been respectfully heard and then those interests balanced, weighed, and discussed in the open so people understand the basis for the ultimate decision.
The ins and outs of local government, that's what we're talking about today in The Exchange. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And a couple great emails and Facebook comments here that I want to share with all of you. Here's Steve on Facebook. I grew up in Hollis and was on the town high school renovation replacement committee. I think the biggest obstacle to local government is the state's tax structure, which funds everything through property taxes rather than fairer options like income tax. Steve says, since every investment requires passing a bond, it always meets lots of resistance from homeowners. Reliance on property taxes also leads to New Hampshire's infamous sprawl development, since towns grasp at any new tax-paying development, whether or not it contributes to the local economy, aesthetics, or quality of life. Steve says that's why in New Hampshire you have malls next to malls next to malls and five gas stations and convenience stores in a row. Wow, Steve, thank you so much for the comment. And Scott, I'm going to throw that to you first. How does the state's property tax heavy system of revenue generation affect what you do as a city manager?
Well, I'm going to play Switzerland on that and remain neutral on the state's stance on that. But Steve is right. We are a very heavily reliant property tax state. And, the no-income tax, no-sales tax certainly has a group of followers. But in reality, there needs to be a stream of revenue, and it should be a diversified stream of revenue to help support what the needs are of the state at the local level. In some cases, it could be user fees, as is with the gas tax here. We do have an aging infrastructure system in the state, not only on state roads, but on local bridges and roads as well. It's always been a battle to try to increase, the user fees. If you've got a car, whether it's an electric car or a gasoline car, you're putting wear and tear on our infrastructure. There needs to be a way to pay for that. I'm a big believer in enabling legislation that will allow communities to adopt certain provisions of state law if they choose to. In some cases, it might be along the lines of economic development incentives. Not that the state offers a lot of them, but communities can choose to do that. There's some discussion legislatively about trying to allow some more resort communities to add a bed tax per hotel room per night, or do an additional 1% surcharge, if you will, on rooms and meals tax for a certain community. That hasn't gained a lot of traction in the state to allow that decision making at the local level.
Because the state would have to let you do that.
It has to be.
You couldn't add
1%.
Correct. San Francisco or New York, I think some of those big popular cities add, a percentage or two.
A lot of cities around the country add those surcharges on, and you see it at airports and you see it at resorts all over the country and all over the world. That's not available for the most part in New Hampshire. And those are discussions we're having of, if the state doesn't want to do it, just give me, the local people, a choice if we want to do it in our community or not.
Yeah. So
no different than Keno. That's just going around right now. Keno coming in had to go on a ballot at the local level to be approved by the voters.
I've got an email about Keno, which I'll share in just a second. But what do you think? Maybe you, Michael. Does New Hampshire's heavy reliance on property taxes force towns to just build whatever comes before them so that they can get the cash?
Well, I can't
speak. Makes New Hampshire ugly, as he describes.
I can't speak to every town, but, certainly in most communities, their master plan and their planning board helps guide the type of development that they're going to have. And if you have thoughtful zoning that's in place, it will address those types of interfaces between different uses. And that is so important for a community as it develops, and particularly, when you're going through a growth period, is that you have planned ahead of time and you're anticipating where development's going to go. And then ultimately, economic development and bringing in new taxable value in the community is always a goal. But it does need to be done responsibly, and whatever you bring in needs to have the right kind of return.
You don't want to have, as Steve says, mall after mall after mall, and then five convenience stores, gas stations. Kevin, I'm looking at you because Londonderry is growing like gangbusters, and you've had to think about this.
It is, and it is something we've thought a lot about. We've been able to really grow our tax base in Londonderry to keep the property taxes in check there. The other thing we've looked at is how can we increase outside revenue, things aside from property taxes, such as rental car revenue that we get from the airport, because Manchester Airport resides in Londonderry. Another initiative we've recently taken on is having a solar array put in Londonderry, where we're leasing town-owned land. It used to be a Superfund site, and that's going to be new revenue that is not property taxes. So,
well, you've got a solar array on a former Superfund site?
We do.
Okay.
We just signed a contract to do it. It's going to be the largest solar array in New Hampshire after it's built. So we've actually been able to lower property taxes in Londonderry by growing the economic tax base and at the same time increasing outside revenues aside from property taxes. It's been a formula that's worked well for us. Granted, not every community is positioned where Londonderry is geographically, so they may not be able to attract the economic base that we have. But I would say in that instance, you know, the formula is pretty simple. If you keep spending in check at the same time, property taxes won't grow out of control.
Yeah, getting creative, as Scott mentioned. So here is a question about Keno from Garrett in Londonderry. I'll throw this to you first, Julia. How has each town represented on today's panel gone about gaining citizen input on the Keno question? And we should just note, Julia, right, that even if a town or city rejects Keno, you still get the revenues allotted for kindergarten. But go ahead. I'd love for you to answer Garrett's question.
So it's been interesting. There's been very little interest in the western side of the state in Keno. We've had no interest expressed in Hanover in even putting Keno on our warrant. And we have a May town meeting, so it's coming up in 2 weeks. And there's been no desire to even pursue Keno. Lebanon, the neighboring community, did ponder the question of whether or not to put Keno on the ballot. The city council opted not to because they didn't like the message that Keno sent. I think the state was interested because we're a border community and they thought perhaps Vermont traffic would want to come over into Lebanon to purchase Keno tickets. The city council voted no, and they couldn't get enough signatures on a petition to force the article on their ballot for their March vote. So for us on the western side of the state, it's not been a big issue of interest on the part of our local residents. Asking people in casual conversation, talking about this issue as we get out in the community, it's not driving people's interest there.
That's really interesting. What about Laconia? Did you guys vote to put Keno on the ballot in your elections coming up this fall?
We did back last fall, actually, when the legislation passed. The cities got a first crack at it. So the 13 cities with fall had an opportunity. And so where was the public input on it? We had it on the agenda for council discussion about whether or not they wanted to move it to the ballot question in the fall election. And then with the legislation, we were required to hold a public hearing. So we had to advertise it a certain number of days in advance of the election and give people an opportunity to come out. We had maybe five or six speakers, and they all spoke in favor of it. And several of them were business owners that were looking to implement it. So I think statewide of the 13 cities, maybe seven of them, maybe eight, adopted it in the fall. But a couple, as Julia said, didn't even put it on the ballot. In a couple places it was on the ballot, it lost. We've had it. It started up somewhere around Christmas first of the year. The business owners who have it, I think there's four in Laconia, think it's doing great things for their business and drawing in new customers and increasing the average check size at their establishment and all positives on their end.
Wow. Okay. Right. I had forgotten that cities got first crack at it in the fall, and then towns were looking at it, or in the case of Hanover, not looking at it during town meeting season. Just real quick, what about Dover, Michael?
Dover put it on the ballot and rejected.
And rejected it.
And,
okay.
And the nearby community of Somersworth, the bordering community, did accept it.
Kevin, how about Londonderry?
The town council chose not to put it on the ballot, and we told the folks that there could be a citizen's petition for it. We never received one. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if we got one for the next town ballot.
Really interesting. Well, thank you for the question, Glenn. Let's go back to our callers. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. All things local today in the exchange. We're talking with a panel of city and town managers about what it's like to lead locally these days and the wide variety of issues that come before them, how they build buy-in and consensus in their communities, and some of the challenges that they face in terms of development, state policy choices. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to Jason in Somersworth. Hi, Jason. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Hey, I was just calling to ask and see what the panel would have to say about why it's so difficult to give citizens in different municipalities a choice between cable providers and internet providers. I had a conversation with our city manager in Somersworth some years ago, and you know, his short answer was that, you know, it's really, we're beholden to the interest of the cable providers who want to make business with us as a city. And I'm kind of curious if any of that has changed, and kind of as a follow-on, if there's anything citizens can do to support, you know, a more demanding consumer role from the municipality, and whether that, you know, could we federate as counties or as a state to maybe require that there's more than one option? Because as you all probably know, paying for cable, it seems the price keeps going up and the services don't exactly match match the price. So curious.
Well, Jason, thank you so much. And I want to let you know that we did a whole program a while back on internet, why it's less than stellar in this state and really even in this country compared to other countries. And I also want to let you know, Jason, that everybody on this panel nodded vigorously when you called, so they hear you. So, Michael, just untangle that for us a little bit, please.
Well, it's a great question. It's one that actually we do get a lot. The issue is that federal law controls the licensing and of cable providers in each community, and ultimately prevents local communities from getting into mandating or negotiating even different issues like pricing or channel selections or any of the details that consumers would be concerned about. That's driven by federal law, and in response to what citizens can do, I think we need to talk to our congressional delegation and ask them to look at that, particularly with the FCC overseeing the Telecommunications Act, which and the amendments that have happened to that, which is what dictates how cable franchising occurs in communities.
Wow. And we did a whole show on broadband. We did a whole show on net neutrality, the FCC, and so forth. And Jason, everybody wants to jump in on this. So go ahead, Scott.
Well, Mike brings up a great point. And the two questions we hear all the time is how come we can't control the pricing and how come we can't control what channels there are?
And why is it so local? Like, why don't you have more options?
Federal law doesn't allow us on that.
Yeah.
But the other point I wanted to add is people say, how come there's not competition? Another cable company could come in and work under your community's franchise agreement for your cable system, but that would mean they would have to come in and do the entire build out to all of your areas, put all the infrastructure in place, and serve your whole community. And they'd be doing that on speculation without knowing how many customers they would be picking up. So now all of a sudden, if you have two cable providers in your community, they only have 50% of the pie, potentially, each of them. And is somebody going to come in and make that investment and try to go head-to-head with another company with no guarantee of profitability?
So, Julie, is it time to just move beyond cable? Just a whole nother system, right? I mean, it sounds like you guys are really constrained here, and you get lots of questions about it from your residents.
Laura, I've worked on this issue for 15 years.
Really?
I was on the New Hampshire Fast Roads Board that landed that high-speed internet backbone. I've negotiated umpteen franchise agreements with Comcast. There's no issue that frustrates me more than the lack of federal and, quite frankly, state government support for robust telecommunications technology deployment in rural states like New Hampshire. It's very tough for local leaders to get traction. And so we end up, the best we can do is to try and negotiate as aggressive a franchise agreement with our sole cable provider, because the cable companies essentially balkanize states, split them up into territories, and understand that one cable company will not tread where another cable company already serves, in part for the reasons Scott indicated, but also because they don't want competition, because competition forces them to sharpen their pencils, reduce their prices, and do things that they're not particularly inclined to do for their customers.
Well, I was wondering how you aggressively negotiate, to use your word, with somebody who's the only game in town. I mean,
very
seems
difficult.
Like they're holding all the cards. Well, Jason, you hit a nerve there, so thank you very much for calling in. I've got a couple more emails, too, that I want to share, including someone who wants to know about the control, the power that you guys have versus the state. I know this is a big issue in a state where we think we have lots of local control, but it turns out not so much. So we'll talk about that coming up. And we'll hear from you, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9, on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, why high schools and even middle schools are upset about a new smoking alternative called juuling. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, four town and city managers are here, and we're asking what it's like to lead locally these days. Let's get your questions in. What do you think your local government does well? What doesn't it do well? And how do state, and as we're hearing, federal decisions affect the ability of your community and its leaders to make your city or town a better place? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So just before the break, Jason called asking about why can't cities or towns negotiate better cable agreements, and everybody in the room kind of nodded knowingly. And Kevin, I did want to give you a chance to jump in on that.
Yeah, Laura, so I was just saying at the break that we just renewed our cable franchise agreement in Londonderry, and I was new to the process this year. So I came into it thinking the same thing, that, you know, we're gonna lower prices, and because I'm a Comcast subscriber as well. And so I took my town manager hat off and put my subscriber hat on and was like, I want a la carte. I don't want to pay as much. And for all the reasons that were stated, because of the federal rules and everything, there's only so much we can do. But if you can work with your franchise, local franchiser, you can get concessions out of them when you're going through the agreement process. Some of the things we did is we upped the franchise fees that they pay to the town, which pay for equipment to our cable studio and our school system as well. Their senior discounts that they can put in, something we didn't have before that we have now. They can do fiber upgrades as well as part of that franchise renewal. So that there are different things that you can do, although you don't have a lot of leverage over them. But going back to this whole thing about people not showing up, I can't tell you how many public hearings we had on this, and you would think people would have showed up.
Right.
Nobody showed up for it, unfortunately, which is a little discouraging because you often get complaints about the cable company, but then we didn't get any public input for it.
Let's take another call. This is Zach in Dover. Go ahead, Zach. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thanks.
Sure.
So you look at Colorado and a couple other states. They've really gone all out in trying to create community broadband projects, like community-governed, locally-owned fiber optic networks that, you know, can bring to these rural areas a significantly faster internet service with the ability to all collectively bargain as a town or any sort of municipality. And you see now that what they call micro trenching, it's a way of laying fiber optic cable in the ground, fairly easily and inexpensively comparatively to what it's been. And so I wonder oftentimes what the potential of creating community broadband programs within New Hampshire is, and if there's any sort of talk about that among these four.
Yeah, Zach, thank you. And I'm going to turn to you, Julia, because you wearily mentioned that you'd worked on this for 15 years. So go ahead.
Zach, how I wish I were a manager in Colorado. There are a lot of states, particularly in the western part of the U.S., that have been very innovative in bringing high-speed internet to rural portions of their state. Unfortunately, New Hampshire does not allow municipalities to invest in fiber infrastructure. Apparently, the Senate has finally agreed to a bill that has been wandering the state house halls for the last 15 years, because I've lobbied on this bill in favor of this bill for 15 years, that would allow us to invest in broadband. But it now sits on the governor's desk, so it remains to be seen whether or not Governor Sununu will sign off on that. The principal reason that New Hampshire has balked at doing this is that, quite frankly, the telecommunications lobby, which is a very powerful lobby in any state house across the nation, but very much so in New Hampshire, doesn't want municipalities to be involved in fiber deployment or cable deployment, for example, because we have access to municipal bond rates, lower interest rates than the private sector does. They don't want us competing with them. Unfortunately, they're not prepared to do the build out in New Hampshire yet. So they don't want to be involved in the construction, but they don't want us entering the arena and competing with them, because we could, in fact, outcompete them. And so we're stuck between a rock and a hard place in New Hampshire without the ability at the local level to invest in fiber deployment.
Wow. Sounds like time for another program on that. This is real interesting. I do want to move to another very important topic here in New Hampshire. And Scott, I'm going to go to you first because from what I've read, Laconia has been quite hard hit by the opioid crisis. And I wonder how that is affecting, maybe changing, the way that you operate as city manager. Do you have to sort of move pots of money around? Do you have to beef up your police force? Have you had to expand drug treatment? I'm just wondering how that's affected your job and life in Laconia.
Well, I think a bit of all of the above, Laura. Yes, we have been hard hit, but I also think we put it out there and we talk about the challenges we're facing. And I think it's definitely a statewide problem. And I think maybe other areas of the state don't necessarily put out the information as readily. So we've approached it head on, openly. We do have a recovery center right on our main street in downtown through our police department. And we did fund a new position, I think, around 3, maybe 4 years ago now. We refer to it as a PET officer position, prevention, enforcement, and treatment is the acronym for PET, for PET. So we have a dedicated person who gets in contact with all overdoses, with folks who are maybe are with that person when they overdose, family members afterwards, and keeps in contact, gives out cell phone numbers. He's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and has quite a record of not only staying in touch with people, but getting people into recovery and getting them in treatment and staying clean. Through our fire department, we have one of our firefighters who voluntarily went through and trained as a recovery coach. A lot of times our paramedics, our EMTAs are on the scene as well, giving out the information. Sometimes people connect better with the police officer. Sometimes they're more apt to open up, or folks on the scene with a paramedic. So we try to approach
Seems
it both ways.
Seems a little less
ways. Threatening. Yeah, we don't have the resources to do a 24/7 safe station like some of the largest cities in the state do. We just don't have the manpower to say to someone, you can stop in at our fire station and someone will always be there. I mean, we do operate around the clock with full-time staff. But a lot of times we're out on calls or it's weekends and you don't have the administrative team there. So we are working with everybody we can, and we are really facing it head on.
How much has this affected your budget in Laconia? And have you gotten any help from the state in combating this crisis in your city?
I think the conversation is getting stronger at the state, and then through some federal dollars coming down, there is some money becoming made available. We are putting some additional money again through this police officer position in particular. But I think ultimately we're seeing it on a lot of our ambulance runs. I mean, a lot of our calls are going for responses, and in many cases, we're seeing the same people or going back to the same addresses, and it certainly is putting a strain on local hospitals.
Well, I would think it would put a strain on local hospitals and local budgets because it's expensive. Obviously, you need to do it to save lives, but...
And beyond the financial strain, there's the emotional strain of our frontline public safety officials and what they're seeing out there and repeatedly seeing on numerous calls every single day.
So you've got a recovery, treatment and recovery center right on Main Street,
yes,
as you said, Scott. So maybe you, Julia, next, but I want to hear from anybody. What about that? I mean, in other towns, some other towns, this has been controversial. You know, people don't want a recovery center. They don't want a treatment center. They certainly don't want it right on Main Street. Some of these facilities have been rejected in some towns. I just wonder how you're managing your way through that as town manager in Hanover.
You know, it's interesting. In the Upper Valley, quite frankly, the problem is as much a rural problem as it is in our downtown areas, Laura. The frightening aspect of this, from my perspective, is the number of individuals we have dying of overdoses out on rural back roads who are virtually unseen by the community and never touched with treatment. It's disconcerting for our police department. We run the regional dispatch center for 26 communities in the Vermont and New Hampshire
really?
Region.
Hanover does.
Hanover does.
That's
right.
A big responsibility.
It is. And our dispatchers are dealing with a tremendous number of overdose calls with individuals who are a long way from a quick response in a downtown setting because we're such a rural area in the state, and the same could be said of the North Country. This is an additional element to this crisis that makes it very difficult to connect those folks with treatment, and quite frankly, transportation makes it really difficult for them to get access to recovery centers. And we had one of the recovery centers in Claremont, which in our world is pretty close by, recently had to close because of the Hope for Recovery loss of funding. So it's a problem that, in my mind, in our part of the state, is perhaps less well answered than it is in the central portion of the state, where there are more cases, but I think there's also a greater cluster of services.
Yeah, well, Kevin, I remember talking to a police officer from your town, Londonderry, about people pulling off the highway, doing drugs at some local fast food chain right off the exit, and then pulling back onto the highway if they don't overdose at that local fast food chain. I mean, I just wonder how much this has strained your local police response and how you've tried to manage this in your role.
It's been taxing on our resources, to say the least. And as Scott said, you know, it's also what the personnel there are dealing with on a daily basis and, you know, take home with them at night when they're off duty. But, you know, to the credit of both Chief Hart and Chief O'Brien in town, they've done a very good job managing the personnel and managing those resources. It's a huge community effort as well, Laura. You know, it's not just the first responders. It's faith leaders have gotten involved in town, the school district as well. The communities really come together to say, you know what, we're not going to pretend this isn't happening in a town like Londonderry. It is. And how best can we combat it? And it's going to take an entire community effort to do so.
Well, here's an email from Kevin that came in that refers to something we were talking about earlier, talking about getting buy-in from the community, how you guys weigh the different needs and desires of different community members, some of whom have bigger megaphones than others. Kevin says, if your guests need to follow the will of the majority, is there any real options for young people in the northern and middle parts of the state? Kevin says, if there are many more older people and fewer young people, doesn't this mean that the town managers have to follow the majority? It's an interesting question, and I did want to ask you guys about aging demographics anyway. So, Michael Joyle, I'm going to throw that to you first.
Well, ultimately, you know, most decisions are made at the community level based on majority, a majority decision of our city council and whatever policy they set. But ultimately, in my role as a city manager, and I think all of us as managers, one of the things that we try to do is understand both the majority opinion and the minority opinion and make sure that our legislative leaders, our city councils, and even our boards and commissions are aware that there's other points of view in the community. You know, we're talking about citizen engagement and how difficult that is. Well, one of our responsibilities is to try to get citizens to engage, but also to keep our ears open and listen as we go around the community in different forums to understand what residents are thinking and what particular issue. There may be different points of view, different opinions, and we have an opportunity and I think a responsibility to bring that to our decision makers, the councils, the planning boards, the zoning boards, to make sure that they know or at least are aware that they need to consider other than just the majority opinion.
So you need to seek out those other opinions. You know, older people might have more time. They might be retired. They might not have kids at home anymore.
Yes.
You know, younger adults are busy doing a million things,
yes,
careers and kids and stuff. So it sounds like Kevin is saying, you got to listen to them too, even if they're not showing up.
Absolutely.
At those meetings.
You know, one of our values, core values in Dover is to listen to our customers, whoever they may be, whether it's residents or businesses or visitors. And so all of our staff, from our department directors right through to our frontline staff, they're encouraged to listen to the customers and listen to what they're telling them. And ultimately, that feedback comes back up through to myself. And then ultimately, I have a responsibility to make sure that our decision makers, local decision makers, are aware of that.
I'm picturing you, Michael, sort of walking around Dover and just going up to younger people and saying, you know, do you know about this? It's tricky, isn't it? I'll turn to you, Julie, because I can see you want to jump in. I mean, I appreciate Kevin's point. If you're more likely to hear from older residents, then maybe you're making decisions that older residents want. And everybody in New Hampshire wants a younger demographic. So... But you're making decisions based on what older folks say they want because they have more time to come. You see where I'm going with this. Mm-hmm. It's a circle, isn't it? I really appreciate the email, Kevin.
Well, and I'm Kevin, that's a great question. I do think that there are a lot of issues today that are of interest to Kevin's generation that we as managers can get our communities interested in focusing on, in addition to the issues that our older citizens are concerned about. So, for example, we've discovered that in the Upper Valley, our interest in renewable energy and sustainability has pulled in this whole generation of younger volunteers that we didn't have on our radar before. And not only are they energetic, but they bring real expertise that we are relying on to help us move forward in a number of our projects. So I think whether it's public transportation, it's bicycle and pedestrian issues, it's renewable energy.
There's a synergy there. Don't just say old versus young. It's not always
right.
There's not always different.
There are issues for everybody to get involved in, and part of our job as managers is to figure out how to energize the various segments of our community to get active and get involved.
I can see you want to jump in, Scott.
We found we've tried to go with the places where younger folks are to get their input, because some of the younger generation doesn't want to come to a meeting on a master plan and
well, that's
be there
what we're
for
talking
2 hours.
Before. And boards put, and commissions, you know, that sounds
put
very
old fashioned.
The dots
and the sticky notes on
yeah.
the bulletin board and see what comes out. So we've gone to gyms, we've gone to coffee shops, we've set up in parking spots down in Weir's Beach. As people come in, we try to engage them. We've tried to go where they are. A lot of communities in the state do great citizen academies where they kind of train that next generation. And for the most part, those are probably are geared towards a younger to a middle-aged crowd. Sometimes, you know, older folks are certainly welcome. In the Lakes region, we have Leadership Lakes Region, where we try to expose and groom the next folks. Fusion, a young professionals group, again, getting them involved in some of the civic support groups where some of the traditional civic clubs like the Elks, the Lions, are having challenges replenishing their populations. How do you reinvent it and excite today's 20 and 30 somethings?
So my image of Michael walking around downtown Dover just checking out with people isn't too far off base.
I think he does that seven days a week. I think Mike is just walking around Dover.
But where does that new generation of young city and town managers like you all, where does that come from?
We have a municipal managers group in the state, and I know Mike can speak to this much better than I can, but we try to connect with a lot of the colleges and universities and do fellowships and job shadowing and engaging that way. But I'll turn it over to the folks far more knowledgeable.
Well, and Kevin, last question for you, sort of demographic issues, challenges, and how you make it all sing as town manager.
Well, you know, the two biggest issues, I think, in retaining young people in the state are, number one, you know, having a job where they can, it's close proximity to where they're living, a good job. And number two is affordable housing.
Which we didn't even talk about. Yeah.
Both big challenges that the state's going to look at over the next 10 years.
Right. And I know housing is a huge challenge, especially in Londonderry and Hanover. Michael's nodding. Okay, Dover. I'm not sure about Laconia. This has been great, folks. I really appreciate you coming in. There's a lot more we could have talked about. Kevin Smith, it was good to see you.
Great to see you as well, Laura.
Kevin Smith, town manager for Londonderry. Scott Myers, thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Myers, he's city manager for Laconia. Michael Joyle, got that picture of you walking around downtown Dover. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Michael Joyle, he's city manager for Dover. And Julia Griffin, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
Julia Griffin, she's town manager for Hanover. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.